small town music. This is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and there's no producer today. There's no one helping me. Kyle is at work. We are recording during the day, but we do have a great guest today. Man's name is Jesse Malin. I had the pleasure of seeing him perform last night at the Hotel Cafe. I took friend of the show David Wild along, and we had a blast at this show, Jesse. So welcome to Rock Solid.
Yeah, it's good to be here in California and stuff.
It's warm today.
It's warm, but actually when I left New York for this, it's kind of a press tour or whatever we're doing out here promoting the new record and the one show before touring begins, it was way hotter and grosser in New York. So it was kind of a break, you know, for me.
Is it cost effective to come to LA to do a show in preparation for your tour?
Well, one show would have been trouble, but we've been doing some press things.
Okay,
we had a lot. That was the idea, is to promote the record.
Excellent.
So, yeah, it would be otherwise kind of a big ride, but we did it stripped down, you know, just a piano player, guitar player, kind of, you know, occasionally I like to play the songs in more of the essence of the way they were written. And I enjoy a stripped down show. That's something where the band is great, but also if the songs can hold up and I can find a way to put some kind of fever and power into them in the stripped down way, it's kind of fun. It's a challenge, you know.
And you did something that I love last night, and it's very difficult to do, is you, it was kind of like a storytelling type thing. You would sing a song and then tell a story.
Yeah.
And you know, I've seen that before when it is not good.
All right.
You nailed it. You were fantastic.
Oh, I mean, thanks. You know,
you were funny too. And for me, sometimes rock star humor isn't great. Mm-hmm. There's only a couple of guys I know. There's only a couple of rock stars that make me laugh, and it's Dave Grohl, and I think it's Jesse Malin.
Oh, all right. That's good.
I'll kiss your ass.
He's a talented motherfucker.
Yeah.
But, you know, it started when I went out opening for people in Europe in my first solo tour, and I'd always been in bands, and I would say silly, crazy stuff when I was in other groups, but when I went out opening up for Ryan Adams through Europe and the Counting Crows and some other folks, it was just me alone with a guitar, and I'd have a guitar tech. So if things started to slip and I had to tune the guitar, strings, tighten them up, I needed a way, you know, to have something. And,
right.
And so I just go deep into my life stories that were connected to the songs, or kind of trying to tell people as an opener, they didn't know who I was, where I come from. And I kind of always liked it if people were in that setting, and that became a thing. So on the acoustic tours, it's a place for me to babble on, and I don't want to be a comedian. I once tried a spoken word show without the guitar, and it's a funny thing because, you know, you tell these stories and they're great on stage, and you can always launch right into a song. It's the safety net, like, you know, a sad song with a funny story. It's like tragedy plus time is comedy. But doing it one man alone and telling a story, and then you can't go into song. It's like, take a breath. There's another story. And you feel really naked.
Right.
So I've never done it since. I tried it. But I have a big respect for people like Henry Rollins and Jello Biafra and, you know, a lot of great comedians. I'm a big Lenny Bruce fan, you know, have a lot of those records and videos and stuff. So,
well, it was very funny. People were laughing, and it didn't feel like, stage patter. It was like, it felt like it was just flowing right out of you in the moment, which I loved. And whether don't pull the curtain down, I'm just going to pretend
it's a mix,
like,
of both.
Yeah, a little bit of both.
Some things I've said before and some things go, you change things too, and then things just happen. But, you know, I have a lot of friends, like I said, on stage. You know, the world is smaller than you think, especially with all the technology and the internet and everything. We're so connected. But it always, with New York and LA, there's been a thing. A lot of people moved out here, artists, musicians, or people just to get sober or married or whatever. There's definitely, the 3,000 miles, a big connection from the two cities, and you know, so different. But I always have fun playing here, and I always, you know, come out here, and it's like different things. And every place you go, I'm always looking for that weird record store or that crazy clothing store or vegetarian spot.
Right.
And I don't always look at the phone. Sometimes I want people to tell me, you know, or, you know, I want to find it myself walking around, like when I was a kid and I wandered into the Village by accident from Queens on the subway and discovered St. Mark's Place, and they had Ramon's shirts and, you know, all the things that we didn't have in our little middle class, you know, suburban borough of Queens. So I kind of still like that, like take a walk in London and end up, you know, oh, that's the street where that song was written about, and you see the street name and think of some Kinks song or whatever.
I love the Kinks. My wife and I were in London a few years ago, and we did like a whole Kinks tour. Like I found their house, and I found the place where they first played, and all that kind of stuff. We got in a cab, and I was asking the guy, I'm like, "Yeah, we want to do like a Kinks tour." And the guy's like, "What's the Kinks?" And I was like, "Oh, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Because that kills me. Are you a big Kinks fan?"
I'm a huge fan. Yeah, I mean, definitely. You know, probably I like the mid or an early period. Mm-hmm. There's some later stuff too in the '80s that I like, but I think he's a great writer, and I love the smoothness of his voice. I mean, even in the '80s, like songs like "Art Lover" are great.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a new Ray Davies record where it's called Americana. It's the most original name, but it's backed by the Jayhawks, and it's some pretty good stuff on
he
there.
He does a couple spoken word pieces in the middle, on that album too.
Oh yeah. Well, he did his storyteller thing for a while. I once saw it in the West Village in New York. But yeah, I mean, London's full of those things. You go around it, but the cabbie's there for the most part. I'm surprised your guy wasn't Amy Winehouse's dad or whatever. But they usually know a lot because they got to take these courses and stuff, and like they got to go to like a school for the job. It isn't like in New York, they just throw anybody in there. And, you know, even here, everybody's looking at their ways or whatever. They don't know L.A. You're like, "Turn on Sunset. Let's go over to, you know, the Arclight Theater." Like, what? You know, it's like they could be in Peru or something.
Yeah, I mean, I thought when I said Conk Studios that that would be a no-brainer for this guy. But no.
So you went to Muswell Hill and all that stuff.
The whole deal. I told my wife, I want to take one day and I want to do this.
That's Kinks really cool.
Because if I was to say the Kinks, the Stones, the Beatles, and the Who, could you pick who your top is of those four?
Yeah, I could. Yeah.
And do you want to?
I will. Yeah, I would say the Rolling Stones because, you know, the second would be Beatles. Would be a real tie for a short period of time. But the Stones, because, you know, I was watching that documentary, Crossfire Hurricane. It's a really great film.
I mean,
there's so many rock films, and they're not always, you have to be forgiving a lot with rock films. They're not always perfect, and for a lot of reasons, but they're getting better, I think, some of them. And this film, as I watched it, you know, everything they did, like everything you thought, like, well, the Stooges did this, or punk rock did this, or Nirvana did this. The Stones did it all. Like, all the Dolls did that. The Androgyny, they did everything that everyone would go on and do, and they did it well, and they did it probably, you know, first. But I think Mick Jagger and Keith Richards are underrated as writers. I think the band's known as the greatest rock and roll band, and I wouldn't want to necessarily go to every show now and see the same set list and the same hits and no deep tracks. But they, they've written the body of work and the records. I love the 70s records all the way up through Tattoo You and even some of Undercover in the Night in the early 80s. So I think it's just a great stretch. I think there's the sweetness, the sadness, the sleaze, the blues, the band, the thing they have. And then the Beatles, of course, as well. The Who I love, I have a love-hate relationship. I think they're, don't shoot me, but I think they're overrated. I think that, you know, the records that are great for me, Who's Next, and, you know, and some of those things are just so strong. But then there's a lot of stuff that's a long-winded thing, and it really worked when I was 14, but it didn't age as well with me. Some of it that didn't fit into once I got out of that, you know, teenage boy angst, masturbation, you know, kind of hate the world, isolation. It felt different. But the Kinks is very working class, and I love that too. I mean, you know, it made maybe that ended sooner than the Stones, or maybe about the same period. I guess they went on to make their last great record. So I think I would take the Kinks over the Who. But all of them, I think, are all part of the, you know, the architecture of what we have, you know, where we get to lean on. And I love all the punk bands. You know, to me, the Clash would be my Beatles or Stones. The Clash and Ramones would be my Beatles and Stones.
That's your influence.
Yeah, a big part of it. And it was stuff that I was able to be part of in some way when these bands were semi-vital. I mean, I caught the end of the Ramones and the mid-period of the Clash. But to go to those shows when I was 11 or 12 after being a kid that was into Kiss and AC/DC and Ted Nugent.
Right.
And I remember at a point in my life where Ted Nugent was the wildest, most intense thing you could hear until I saw the Sex Pistols on some People's Choice or award show. And I was like, that's what I want. I want to break everything in my room. And, you know, like nobody's going to like accept this. This is like got more. For some reason, we had a lot of anger, me and my friends that didn't fit in. We were kind of these outcast misfits. And the band Kiss hit us at a certain age where it spoke to us, and we said, "Wow, this is great."
Yeah, you know, that was the first concert I saw was Kiss.
Me too, in New York at the Garden. And so, you know, I saw that now I understand why the older kids who like Sabbath and Zeppelin would beat us up and be like, "Kiss sucks." And I didn't get it at the time, but they're a great rock band. But I see that if you were a little older, you might have saw through like some of the novelties, but they had great songs, and Ace is a great guitar player.
Yeah.
But so we'd get into fights, and you had to defend what you liked, but Then when I got into punk, you know, everybody hated you. It wasn't just the other rock fans. It was like the disco kids, and you were just such a weirdo. It's very different now. But there's something to being said about being really passionate about what you're into. Like you're saying The Who, like you're watching Quadrophenia, the Mods and the Rockers. And, you know, I'm not into violence, but people would fight for what they were into. Right. Now people go to Coachella. I think I touched on this last night. And, yeah, I like everything. And I like a little of this and a little of that. And, you know, it's just whatever my Spotify shuffles me up to today. But I think there is something great about being really dedicated to something that you have to stand up for and believe in, because it's like that with your values and with life. And,
absolutely.
You know, so if you're into the Clash, you know, you got to be ready to wear that red t-shirt.
It's so funny too, when I listen to like the first Kiss albums now, or even the first Ramones albums, they sound so tame.
They do.
And I can remember when I would play this and my parents would be like, oh my God, what is this stuff you're listening to? This is awful. And it's like so... It is like nothing now. I mean, not nothing, but it's, you know what I mean.
Yeah, we thought that was the heaviest shit. The heaviest, and you listen thing. To Gene Simmons' bass lines, and they're like a wedding band, bar mitzvah, like Happy Days. They're very 50s. Yep. And
it's very hip hop. Not hip hop, I mean sock hop.
Yeah, very sock hop, just friendly. And it didn't seem as scary. And even the Sex Pistols record, which remember I put that on, and remember my father was like, what the hell is this? And it's still an amazing record, that one record. And it holds up so well. Production, Chris Thomas and Bill Price. I mean, it's just phenomenal. But they're pop songs.
Yes.
You know, like totally Glenn Matlock wrote these pop songs.
It's not dangerous you thought it was.
Yeah. I mean, I could see what a danger is, and I still can get the anger, but there's these great choruses, you know, and they're a rock and roll band. And that's pretty interesting. One record. Like,
I know.
You think of all these bands, they just made one. I mean, you know, you can't really count the soundtrack thing they did, but it's like if they go out and play, they play that one record.
That one record.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about it, because you have an EP out right now.
Yeah.
Now, what's the thought behind making an EP instead of a full album at this point?
Well, you know, I guess when we started as kids in the hardcore punk thing, we would do singles and EPs because that's all we could afford to do.
Okay.
In New York, the hardcore scene was pretty broke. And even, you know, groups like the Bad Brains, their first thing came out on a cassette, you know, that was through a company that sold cassettes. And it's their best work, the Roar cassette. But, you know, it was different. You know, the bands on the West Coast when we were in our early teens would come out, Circle Jerks, Black Flag, would put full-length albums and Bad Religion and all these groups. And it was hard. And so my first record was a 3-song EP, a band called Heart Attack when I was 14. It was called God Is Dead. I was very philosophical there. But and that was on a fanzine's label. And it's still a record that is out there. You can find one. But the idea, I guess, goes back kind of to punk days or 50s. Like at one point, The Clash tried to do a single a month, or that you can put music out. So it was exciting to me to do something simple. And everybody, whatever the music industry is, and that's a whole other story, but people are like, oh yeah, the album cycle is dead, and the album, and you can just do EPs, and John Mayer just did 2 EPs and put them out, and then he's going to put the whole thing out, and people just care about songs, and you know, and everything's so disposable these days, right, where people, you know, have the attention span of a goldfish, and you know, everything's deleted and moving on. So it wasn't the point of it, but you kept hearing that, yeah, you can just do an EP. But I'd been on tour with a guy named Alejandro Escovedo, an artist who is a friend of mine and a great guy from Southern California, from Mexico.
Yeah, Springsteen talks about him a lot.
He's done some stuff with Alejandro. Yeah. They had similar management. Alejandro was in Rank and File. He was in the Nuns. And he's also been making solo records for a long time. And a great storyteller. So we were touring with him. And we were actually out west, out here, and driving around and, you know, watching the news and listening to, you know, the radio and jamming at sound checks, and these songs just started to come. On acoustic tours, I have a lot of time, especially if you're opening for somebody, your energy isn't totally, you know, decimated from like a 90-minute show with a band and saving your voice. You have, you know, you're doing 45 minutes in acoustic, and I like it a lot and can tell some stories and jokes. So it gives time to write in dressing rooms and in hotels and looking out the window of a vehicle. There's something about that motion and looking at a country or a town and listening to the news and music. So these songs just start to happen. And then we got an offer for the summer to do some kind of good, bigger gigs for me. One was Lollapalooza in Chicago in August.
That's great.
And Hyde Park in London, which is like their Central Park, you know, to do a show with Green Day and Gogol Bordello and Rancid.
And are those full band shows for you?
They're full bands. It's a 7-piece band with the horns and all. And so I was like, well, we're going to go on this. We're going over for one show at Green Day in Hyde Park. we might as well book a tour. So, yeah. And if we're going to go out to Chicago for Lollapalooza, we might as well book an America tour. And if we're going to go on tour, we need a 2017 release. So here are these songs. Can we get this done? Because I always want the vinyl to be out there as well. You know, that takes the vinyl plants. It's gotten so popular. They're backed up. So you got to get it into the system. And can we get the artwork and everything in and bang this out? And I had been working with a guy named Joseph Arthur. He's a really great artist, singer, songwriter, producer. And we had worked on something for the Positive Panther charity. We did one song called London Rain, a song of mine I wrote about our old merch girl who got sick with cancer and ended up paralyzed.
You talked about her last night because you were out here and you did a
We did the Roxy for her. I used my birthday show to make it a benefit to get her a special wheelchair so she could be mobile. And a lot of people knew her. She worked with Ryan Adams and Tommy Stinson and Martha Wainwright. So during that, I figured, well, I'm doing this charity. I should have a song. And I just thought, you know, I got this ballad about her, London Rain, and how she's such a fighter. You know, we call it a Positive Panther. And I kind of want to spook it up a little bit. I don't want it to just be like guitar, piano. I want like some other factor. And who do I know? And I thought of Joseph because he's pretty arty, artistic guy. He was signed by Peter Gabriel to Peter Gabriel's label originally. And he has an edge. So we went out to his studio in Red Hook, Brooklyn, behind a chop shop, a junkyard, or auto parts place. And he's a painter as well, so there's all kinds of great paintings all over the place. And we banged out this song in one afternoon, and he just put all this other stuff around, and that would be London Rain. We did a video. And when it was time to do these other songs and try to get this summer EP out, I said, let's go with Joseph. And we went into a studio, a bigger studio, and we knocked him out. And he was able to bring in another perspective. And it happened fast and easy and was fun. And that's, you know, what rock and roll records should be. So, it's those songs. And the title song is Meet Me at the End of the World, which is the first single.
Well, let's hear that. Let's hear a little bit of Meet Me at the End of the World.
On 24th Street, and I'm looking at a life. Standing on the corner, watching people passing by. I used to be somebody, man. I used to be someone. Now I'm feeling like a bullet in the chamber of a gun. I said, hey, tell me what you're gonna do now. Acting like you've never been had.
And people that are still afraid of vinyl know that the vinyl comes with a download card.
Yeah.
So you can download the songs into your iTunes. It's a good looking vinyl too. It's got an insert in it because sometimes it's an EP. Maybe just have a white insert, but you got.
I want the lyrics. I'm big on the lyric sheets. Yeah. I always like to know what everybody was saying. I mean, there's some good mystery not knowing. After the Mick Jagger shit, I didn't know what he was saying.
I know. Yeah. Like Strummer sit there with the headphones on and play it over and over and over again. But yeah, I remember when I would buy albums when I was a kid, and be like that, just that clear insert, that flimsy thing, or just the white paper.
Yeah,
that would piss me off.
Yeah, it sucked. You're like, come on. But you know, people are really into the experience now. Like, and as I was saying recently too on stage, you know, it's just like people are collecting these records again.
Yeah.
They're liking the sound of it. They're liking the whole experience and the size of it to be able to look at the record. And before we had all this information, you know, you just sat with the record and you know, it was left to your brain to have more mystery and romance with it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm still a CD guy.
Okay.
But I do collect vinyl to get signed. Like I have like 100 albums signed and they're hanging on my wall.
Yeah.
I know people that get stuff signed and they just put it in their closet. I'm like, well, that's a waste.
I always didn't understand people that were such collectors that they put it all in a plastic bag and didn't touch it.
Yeah.
I'm like, you can't be buried with it. Like, no. You know, it's meant to be used.
I like people to see it. And
yeah,
and,
or do and, something. Yeah, you know, it's like, oh, I have it. Oh, it's locked up in this closet, you know.
Yeah, I like people to say, when did you get Tom Petty's autograph? And then I have a story to tell them. It's
right.
Fun. So let me ask you about, D-Generation, that was your first, like big foray into recording music?
Well, like I said, Heart Attack was from when I was 12 to 16. So that would be my first band. And we did three records.
And see, I didn't even know it. Look at that. Look at me. I'm supposed to be doing my homework and I didn't even know about this. But 12 to 14.
Yeah, the 16. Yeah.
12 to 16.
First, we started at 12 at CBGB's. They had an audition night on Mondays. And the you know requisite was you had to play original music. So I called from the school payphone and we drove in one of the mom's cars and we had heard of the Ramones and Blondie and the Talking Heads and suddenly we were on that stage, you know, scared shitless, just going to play Monday audition night of our original tunes. You know, I'd got tired of trying to learn Van Halen licks and Jimmy Page right. And I heard the Ramones. I'm like, oh, three chords. My guitar teacher was like, well, look at this. And then I started writing my own songs. So we had the originals. We were called Heart Attack and we went in and we did not pass the audition because I found out years later that you had to bring 25 drinking friends, which makes sense, you know. We brought nobody, and we didn't drink, you know. We were still on Coca-Cola. And so, you know, we played, and they said, well, you missed it. It's over. You know, that stuff happened. The Dead Boys, Ramones, the Pistols, you know, that's done. And it's true. A lot of those bands were going funky or power pop or disco or whatever to cash in or just grow as artists. And so we didn't know, you know, what to do. And they said, you should try something new, like rockabilly or, you know, new romantic. I'm like, I'm not going to dress up like a pirate. So eventually I went further east to Avenue A, which was a real no man's land, made the Bowery look nice, and saw a flyer for a group, the Bad Brains, which was an all-black hardcore band from D.C., but it wasn't called hardcore at the time. It wasn't a real term. And suddenly there was a movement of certain groups that were speeding up the pace, wanted to have something that was their own that wasn't the 70s thing. There was a different consciousness, and it was happening around the country, but you only found out through fanzines and magazines like Flipside and Damaged out on the West Coast and Slash and in D.C. and in L.A. with bands like Black Flag and in San Francisco, the Dead Kennedys. And when they would tour, it would just be this little communication that this thing, or you go in a record shop and some guy would tell you there's this record that just came in. So we started to create this own little scene in New York, and that would be the New York hardcore scene, and Heart Attack would be probably the first release, not to brag, of New York hardcore on the Damaged Goods label, which was a fanzine. And as that scene grew, I was in it till I was about 16, did three records. We toured, we came out west, played the Olympic Auditorium.
And is that music available anywhere?
It's absolutely available. I think it's on, you know, iTunes for sure, maybe Spotify. Okay. There's also a compilation called the Roar Cassette, which has the Beastie Boys, Bad Brains, Heart Attack, The Undead.
See, I don't know anything. I'm going to have to find this music.
Yeah, it's different. You know, I mean, it's hardcore. It's early, and it's young, you know. But we were, you know, living in a time of Ronald Reagan, and the draft is a potential threat, Central America and war. You know, it was like kind of kooky times, the nuclear arms race and all. And so we somehow felt we were the Reagan youth, you know.
And your parents were cool with you doing this at such a young age?
Well, it was artistic. I wasn't into drugs. I still have never tried cocaine or anything like that. I've had a hit a pot. I drink, you know, but I'm into being kind of healthy. But it was always about the music. And my mother understood that. My dad, they had separated. So he was living elsewhere. And my mom was trying to raise two kids. And she was young. And she was trying to have a life and work and deal with us. And I was pretty intense. So I think the guitar took the violence out of my hands. You put the guitar in your hand, and suddenly I've had something to channel all this energy into. And she was a frustrated, you know, hairbrush mirror singer that sang at, you know, somebody's wedding, get up there. And, you know, I think, you know, it was always in my family some kind of fantasy, a romance of show business. And so she was supportive of the arts and doing your thing, and even drove us in a big old used boat of a car to Max's. We didn't get the CBGB's gig, but we did get booked at Max's. The booker from Max's Kansas City, the legendary club, was at our audition, and I got a call. I thought it was a joke, you know. And when you're that young, you got to be careful because, you know, people in the city, around the music scene, you know, there was some sleazy people. I mean, I did get hit on by women, but by some men, you know, and it didn't understand it at first what was happening. And you just, you know, luckily things didn't get stupid or anything. Somehow I got a sense that they're not going to somebody's office at a, you know, nightclub or whatever, and, you know, in the middle of the night. So, but that was a good time doing the music, and we got to go around the country, and it was a real network. People out in different cities would put us up, and there was a real DIY kind of thing about it. And so we toured with GBH, Dead Kennedys, we played with Social Distortion, a lot of great bands.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was real fun. And
were those bands kind of take you under their wing at all since you were so young? Did they?
Some people were, just supportive. Mm-hmm. Someone like Jello Biafra, the singer of the Dead Kennedys, or Ian MacKay of Minor Threat, would work in their areas or even in the country, trying to put bills together and support the so-called scene, and which was only thriving on this underground way of people helping each other out.
Yeah.
But it was all kinds of people people that are unsung, people that would just put you up and just let you stay at their house, lend you equipment. The Bad Brains, who were the best players we knew, would always lend their gear to everybody. You could get, and we didn't have good stuff. We had Japanese guitars and weird things, and they were a little older, and they had great equipment. They had been a jazz fusion band before a punk band, and so you'd get to hear yourself like, wow, if I had this amp and this guitar, I might sound like the Bad Brains. Well, that's not going to happen, but you could sound a lot better and realize that what you play is part of it.
What was the drug scene like for these older bands that you were opening for, touring with?
Well, there were people that were getting screwed up, but there was this thing also that was so great about early hardcore. Not only did it have its own sound and its own look and its own energy and its own things to sing about, so it wasn't the 70s thing. And we were kind of political and socially aware as much as you can be at that age. And some people that were older actually were more educated about what they were saying. It was this thing that certain people were putting out there that were really into the music, and hey, we're going to be screwed up and intense and wild and have something to say and in your face, the establishment, and we're going to be sober. So deal with that, not like, all right, well, he's messed up. We'd watch so many people like Sid Vicious and Johnny Thunders, and there's a romance to this messed up junkie, but it never was sexy to me. I didn't know what an after hours club was. I'd go to, some basement at a place called Save the Robots on Avenue B after a show, and it's like 4 a.m. and there's no bands. And I don't know why these people are here till 7. I didn't get it,
Right.
And they're playing this, it's not rock and roll music. And yeah, they're looking to hook up. But it just never seemed sexy to me. It seemed like a way that you were going to burn out and lose your power and your message. And the artists that I've always loved were great performers that put everything they had into it, whether it was Angus Young in AC/DC, killing himself every night, Bruce Springsteen, who I would get into years later, HR from the Bad Brains, Jello Biafra, Iggy Pop, people, Henry Rollins, that would come on stage and go, this could be the last night of my life, and so, I'm going to give you everything. Yes. It wasn't romantic to see some guy with his eyes rolled back, like sweating and it can't move. It just looked like a bad night with the flu, and that was never fun.
Now, you're doing this at such a young age. What was happening with you in high school? Did you graduate high school?
I tried to go to school in Queens because my mom was from that generation where you're going to go to college, like that 50s, 60s mentality. I said, Mom, I'm going to go on tour. I'm not going to go to college. And she said, you'll regret that. So I tried to go to school in Queens. And
so you finished high school?
I did it. No, I'll give it. This is a little quick story, but it's funny. So I tried to go to school in Queens, and I was getting into a lot of fights for wearing clothes that I bought in the city and, being into bands and punk rock, and it wasn't acceptable, and it was not fun. And I wanted to be on the road, and I got offers to go. We went to Mexico City for 2 weeks with Heart Attack. We went to California. And they were going to expel me because I was missing too much school. So there's another band called Reagan Youth. My friend Andy Apathy, the bass player, said, there's this really cheap private school in the city called Quintanos, the School for Young Professionals. And it's $1,600 a year. And if you want to go on tour, they accept it and they give you the work and it's accredited for college. So we didn't have any kind of money like that in my family. But on my father's side, my grandmother, not wealthy, in the Bronx, but I called her up and I said, I got this private school. It's a music school, kind of like Juilliard. And it's only and so somehow they said yes, and it was really nice that they did that. And so you didn't have to really go about it. This was a legitimate school called Quintanos, where Steven Tyler had went, Michael Jackson had spent time there, Bernadette Peters, you could look it up, Johnny Thunders. Tons of people had put time in there. And now it had literally degenerated. It was the 80s, and Dr. Quintana was in his early 90s, and he was blind as a bat, and the woman that answered the phone was in her 80s. So you could call up, you could be in Central Park getting drunk and say, I'm on tour, and not go in.
Right.
But I did go in. I didn't sit in Central Park drunk, but they really weren't watching, and some of the teachers... Spin Magazine did an article on this a few years back, a while back, and it called it the Real Rock and Roll High School. And they would come into class, these guys in suits, and they would point at certain kids, and then it would leave with these guys. And I looked out the window, and I saw these town cars. I said, I want to get out of here. I'm sick of biology class. And my friend Andy Apathy said, you should come with us, Jesse. You got a Japanese guitar. Don't you want to get a Gibson? So, yeah. He said, well, these women, these rich women, while their husbands are playing blackjack, they'll pay you lots of money to suck on your balls for hours. And once in a while, you got to be with a man.
Oh, no.
I said, I think I'll just sit in biology class. So I forgot about it. And then my mom kept saying that. Mickey
the
Mouse,
Japanese guitar looked better
yeah,
and better.
Yeah, eventually I got the Gibson SG. But they went and they did their thing. And, you know, and my mom would say, that Mickey Mouse bullshit school, it better be accredited for college because you're going to go to college. Well, unfortunately, just after I graduated, whatever the graduation was, my mom passed away. She died of cancer. It was pretty heavy. I had to move home and take care of my sister. And I was living in the city. This mm-hmm. is in my rehearsal room. And I had to go back to Queens. And it was a rough time for me. But during that time, you know, I found other ways to survive. I needed to have my equipment. I needed to rehearse. I needed to play live. I got a cheap van and I used it to move other people and move. I worked for everybody from the Swans to Barbara Streisand and the Ramones in their T-shirts and NYU students moving. And so it was kind of an interesting thing. I had a beeper. It was before cell phones. And my mom would say, you know, that, and she passed away. So then years later, I was in a bar with one of my friends who went to the school, and he said, Jesse, you know that school we went to? It's like 4 a.m, we're drunk on Avenue A. You know, Quintanos, you know, it wasn't accredited for college. And I'm like, all right, we're drunk. It's 4 a.m. Who cares? We're not going to college. We're in our 20s now. And, you know, they were running a male prostitution ring out of the school. And I was like, I guess I knew that. Like, I just kind of spaced it or right. put it in some denial box somewhere. But I did get through with that and didn't go to college. I spent some time at NYU. I always liked film a lot. I would sit in on classes. My friends did go to NYU, some of the other kids, and I would just crash at their dorms. And mm-hmm. there was a class called Scorsese Coppola, and it would just show movies and talk about movies, you know. And, you know, things like that were always interesting to me. The photo classes, the NYU photo school. Yeah. It was all down in the village and connected close to the club scene. And so then after that, I had a low period where I was in a band called Hope, which is similar to what I do now, songwriter driven thing, influenced, you know, by just storytelling, rock and roll. And that wasn't going too well for me. It was the only band that didn't record records. And I was still trying to catch up from my mom passing and having my sister to take care of and not really sure where we were going to live. And that was about 5 really down years. And then one night, I just said, you know what? It's like a band for fun, kind of like the band we wished we saw when we were in the 70s, right. like Aerosmith, Kiss, the New York Dolls, and the Dead Boys, and, you know, all wrapped into one, the Stooges. And I said to my roommate, Howie Pyro, you know, you want to, let's just make a band. I'm not going to play guitar and try to be earnest. I'm going to take my shirt off and jump around, and we're just going to have fun, and let's play this party that we've been DJing at, and we called it Degeneration, it was kind of a joke band. And suddenly, we got a record deal, and things started to move, and me fighting with this band, Hope, to try to even get, you know, a single out, mm-hmm. everything was falling into place by not caring, you know, and having fun.
Let's hear from the first Degeneration album. Let's hear No Way Out. I also want to play this song because you re-recorded it for your second album.
Okay.
Because look, it's different.
Oh yeah, it's faster.
And the bass feels like it's more out front too.
This is done by Rick Ocasek from the Cars. Produced this one. The first is David Bianco. Was at the gig last night.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the guy who produced the first No Way Out. Yeah, great guy, great producer.
So, your second album, how do you get hooked up with Rick Ocasek?
We were on EMI for the first record, and that was our first record deal, and we were so excited. You know, we got a major deal, and we're on tour with the Ramones, and we got some money, and then we got dropped. The president got fired, the guy that believed in us. They took him out of
EMI.
That's
the story I always hear.
And so we got a new guy, David Segerson. I remember the name, and he wasn't a fan. It was someone else's baby, you know. So They let us go. And at that time, No Way Out, the song you just played, the first version, was on the radio in New York like 35 times a week on the big rock station. We had a feature in Rolling Stone.
So cool.
When people still read magazines. And things were going. We sold out Irving Plaza, and this president of EMI comes to see us, and he says, "I don't get it." Boom, we're dropped. So I figured,
why does a guy like that not get it? If he sees that it's being played on the radio and he sees that that's sold out, so what if he doesn't get it? These people that are paying money get it.
Yeah.
That never makes sense to me.
It was an odd thing. I don't know if he saw the future, or he just thought maybe it was just big in New York. I don't know what it was, or it was just he was pissed that it was someone else's thing. And he was more of a dance guy, a dance background from what I remember.
That always drives me crazy too. If I took over someone else's executive position, but he already had a roster of people that were doing well or up and coming and probably going to do well, why would I be pissed off about that?
Yeah, it was very odd. In fact, a lot of people came to our defense. But I remember he came to a sold-out show. We were in Rolling Stone by David Frick that week, and we were on the radio 34 spins a week. It was, I'd get in somebody's car, and the song would come on. Be like, wow, this is happening. And so we were dropped. And friends that were maybe 4 or 5 years previous to me that had been in rock bands around the Guns N' Roses time in the late 80s, that got dropped. They were, working at a shoe store on St. Mark's Place, in a record store. I'm going to go back to moving furniture. And my manager and publicist said, no, we're going to get another deal. And I'm like, well, I never heard of that. I really didn't believe it. And they were right. And these people came out and spoke in the New York papers, in Daily News, in the Post. A program director was interviewed by somebody at Q104, the station. Vinnie Marino was the guy's name. And he said, yeah, the song was reacting and it was getting played a lot. And then the label said, stop playing it and play Queensryche. And so we had to listen to the promo. So we had people saying that the shift was unjust or whatever. This life is life. And the funny thing was, next thing we have five labels, and we're flying out here to play for A&M and Virgin, and we decide to go with Sony. I think the A&R guy that would be James Diener, he just really impressed us with the whole staff, and it felt in every New York, and I think part of us also liked that label, that Columbia Records, from looking at the Bob Dylan and Springsteen and Aerosmith records as a kid. It was just, it had a thing. Don Einar was the president. He just came on real strong. He took us to a party out here, Grammy Week in Rodeo, and we met Robert De Niro and Springsteen and Spike Lee and Mike Ness from Social D. It was like all of
How can you not sign with these guys?
I don't know.
Guys?
They would just seem like they really wanted it. And, who knows? So we end up with them, and we got really good amount of money, which in those days, maybe, not to sound like an idiot bragger again, but it might have been the biggest deal that an unknown band on Sony had gotten.
Hey, look, if it's true, then you, yeah. It's not bragging.
No, I think that's the
true.
Truth. It's really silly. But so we had a lot of money at our fingertips, and we actually made them sign the contract. They said, we want to sign and take a photo. Everything was a big deal then.
Right.
So we made them open up the Cyclone roller coaster at Coney Island. I have photos of this. Off season, and get in the roller coaster car with the president of the company and all his execs and sign the contract and then go ride the Cyclone. And Bob Gruen, the rock photographer, took those shots. So we signed with them, and we had this A&R guy who was very meticulous. We met with everybody, and we picked Rick Ocasek from the Cars because he was an artist. He was artist friendly. He had worked with the Bad Brains, and they're pretty volatile. And worked with Suicide, Rick, and with Alan Vega, and he had done the Weezer record we liked, the blue one, and Bad Religion, and Courtney Love. And so, we just felt like we met with him in a coffee shop in 14th Street, and everybody, the band Degeneration was five guys that grew up together in Queens, and it was brothers. It was a real brotherhood. It was a real band, whether you liked the music or not, we were a real team.
So no infighting.
Complete infighting.
Complete infighting. Oh,
love
brothers.
And hate,
yeah, sure,
everything. Okay. I mean, it was it could be so disrespectful and so loving and so intense, but that's what made the live shows really fun.
Gotcha.
To be part of something real. It's like a five-headed nut house monster. And so sometimes we weren't always very respectful to people, producers and stuff. But once Rick Ocasek came in, a soft-spoken, tall guy that had these great records with the Cars that we all grew up on, everybody shut up. And we made that record really fast and really painless. It's called No Lunch. And loved working with Rick. I mean, we had a great time with David Bianco, but this was another experience. It was our second record, and it came out about 20 years ago.
Yeah, 1996. Let's hear a little of She Stands There. Stop believing. There's something special inside. Great. Sounds great. Do you, when you're doing like these full band shows, do you get into any of this stuff too?
No, we did some Degeneration shows last couple years, and we put out a record called Nothing Is Anywhere last July.
Yeah.
And so I keep those things separate when we do that band, and it's those five people. With my stuff, there might be things that are similar to that energy-wise occasionally. But it was a clear change to do my solo records and have a different place. I wanted people to listen more to the lyrics and the songs and just kind of break it down. But over the years, the energy and the need for jumping around and stuff crept back in.
Well, I want to jump. I want to play one more Degeneration song, then I want to get into your solo material. But the third album, Through the Darkness, produced by Tony Visconti.
Yeah.
And did you get hooked up with him the same way through the label? Just you met people and...
He had always mentioned interest in working with us, and we kind of, you know, passed each other in the city. He lived in New York, and of course, we had mad respect for T-Rex records and Bowie records and all that 70s greatness.
Thin Lizzy.
Yeah, and you know, I always thought he was English, but he's a guy from Brooklyn, but he'd spent so much time in England. And
I just met him a couple months ago. He's healthy and looks so
good. Martial arts. And
yeah.
He was dating May Pang at the time, so she was around the studio a lot, and we... We had a good time with Tony. You know, he came in and, you know, it just another one of those situations where I think, well, the band was kind of starting to maybe put more friction on each other. It was the third record. It was a lot of pressure from the label. We had been on tour with Green Day and we had been on tour with Kiss and Offspring and all these great bands. And we were trying to find like this next record. It was kind of our last chance. And we had been 6-7 years at this point as a band. And, it was kind of really great in major cities, you know, and we had a great cult following and artists really loved us, but we'd go out into the Midwest or to other places and it was, we were getting hit with chains and getting bottles in the head.
You're in the Midwest and you're opening for Kiss or Green Day and the audience isn't accepting you guys?
Sometimes with Kiss, no, with Ramones, but with Green Day was probably one of the shows, the tours. We did Europe with them too. We're really connected. Mm-hmm. But they also were very supportive. The drummer, Trey Cool, would get in the pit on our first song. And I was like, look around. This guy's getting the whole crowd going, and he's got a drum tonight? It was pretty nuts, pretty great. But, yeah, some of that was better. But people didn't care about my lyrics. They didn't, you know, they just wanted to slam and mosh and go around the circle and stuff. And we could have been singing the phone book. So I was getting kind of frustrated. I found myself on the tour bus.
That makes sense.
Listening to Wilco and listening to Whiskey Town and Neil Young and Steve Earle. And Tom Waits. And you know, I grew up with, before Kiss, with early Elton John and Jim Croce and, you know, songs. I always loved, you know, sad acoustic type stuff too. So I started to lean towards that. The last song on Through the Darkness, the Tony Visconti record, is a Neil Young cover, Don't Be Denied. And I think the other last song is a ballad I wrote about my girlfriend called Violent Love. It's just a sad, you know, tour song. But so the writing was on the wall a little bit that something had to change. And
when you're writing like that, was the band receptive to that? Or were they like, this isn't really what we do, Jesse?
Some felt that it wasn't right for us, that I should put it somewhere else. And some of the guys were really into it. You know, it's a good diverse record collection amongst us all. But, you know, you got to have certain things for certain audiences. You get out in a certain energy. And so it was time for that band to end, I guess, in its own way. There's a lot of love, and there still is, and it's great to get back with them. And the new record, I think, is really fun. You know, Danny Sage, the guitar player, produced it, and we got to keep it really nasty with our front house guy engineering it. And then I felt like, you know what, it's time to do this thing and be a solo artist. And I was very scared about, you know, being under my name and all that. I liked being in a band as much as I liked wanting to be a leader,
right?
But I didn't know, like, it seemed very adult to be called Jesse Malin. It was very like James Taylor.
Yeah.
Well,
you're definitely putting yourself right out there.
I didn't think it was very rock and roll too. I was worried about that. You know, I was still 30 years old or something, and I didn't have a lot of money to make the record, and I couldn't get a deal right away. And I found myself back in New York DJing at clubs, and I formed a band right before that called Bellevue. It was kind of a bridge band. It made one record, but it was kind of a little bit of DJ and a little bit of what the Jesse Malin records would be. And I think I was just scared to make the leap. And then one day Ryan Adams, who I'd become friends with through Degeneration, he had gone from Whiskey Town to being a solo artist as himself. And he said, you write the songs, you pay for rehearsal, you know, you do all the work. just call it yourself. And I was like, you know what? He did it, and he did really well at it. Of course, he's a super talent, but it just seemed to be that was the last push I needed. And I didn't have the money to record this record, but I was living on the safest block in New York City, the Hell's Angels New York chapter block, East 3rd Street. You don't need bars on your windows. You don't need anything because they're out there watching the block. It's a motorcycle club. They're watching their bikes. And I was paying nothing to live there. And some slumlord bought the building and offered me like $29,000 or something to, you know, it was a lot of money back then. Still is a lot of money to leave, just to leave. Of course, I'm going to have to find another place to live. So I paid off some debt so I could walk on some other blocks. And the rest of the money we had to go in the studio. And Ryan was on tour for, I think, Gold. And he had, I don't think he'd produced too much before that, but he'd done some late night sessions of stuff, demos. And he came in 5 days we did the Fine Art of Self-Destruction.
You did this whole album in 5 days?
Yeah, that was it. He had because 5 days between tour. It was very live, and he had a great idea for... to mic the drums very minimally, 3 mics to give it a real room sound. It's been compared, some people said it sounds like, you know, more 60s or like an early Rolling Stones kind of Andrew Lou Goldham production. And I thought he did a fabulous job, and I was very lucky to have, you know, his input.
Well, this is from 2003. This is from the Fine Art of Self-Destruction. This is Queen of the Underworld.
You say you want a revolution, something you can touch. Like an age-old contradiction with alcohol and lust. In all the things you have are broken.
There's the 60s in, right in there, that little...
Yeah.
And you can't
and that's him on guitar playing those stabs, those kind of walk-on-by stabs.
From dysfunction.
You can do this in 5 days.
Yeah.
You can. Everyone can't, but you can. You and Ryan.
I don't know. I don't think I've done it like that since. I had no choice. There's some flaws in there, though.
I like your voice because you can. It's kind of like a chameleon. Like you can sing like that, but then you can really rock it up, and then you can really like just. The vocals can just shred. If I have to use that word, I will.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's, that's, I love this record. I'm going to play, let's hear a little bit of, Wendy.
Wendy left me all alone. No postcard or telephone. Winter time down by the beach. The jukebox bar way out of reach. Like Tom Waits and the Poet's Heart, 60s kinks and Kerouac. Through the night, her tell I'd fade. Her selection never played.
And then you played a song off this album last night. You played Solitaire.
Yeah.
Dedicated it to Lemmy.
Yeah.
That's a great song too.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, this is a great album. Now, what did this album, what did it do? Did it, was it, did people find it? Was it successful?
This
I found
record,
it.
Yeah, this record got really good reviews and, you know, the English magazines. Nobody knew D-Generation in England, so I went over there with Ryan. It was like I was a new artist, so it was a new rebirth to be able to reinvent myself or sort of whatever.
And were you opening for him or were you playing
together?
I was
opening for him in theaters, and yeah, again, his generosity was just really important and really amazing and just made a big impact. But got to come out there and tell some stories and play some songs and... And yeah, it was. It just felt like things were brand new again. And this record, people seem to listen to the lyrics and talk about the songs. You know, first record, even though it wasn't my first, but it was my first solo record. Right. I'd been singing and writing for 4 other people. So you're very conscious that you're writing songs that the other dude's got to back. It's a band, even though if you might be one of the main lyricists, you know, it's a certain head and a certain attitude. And here it was like, all right, I'm just writing for myself, me, myself, and Irene, you know, and I can put, you know, whatever I want up there and examine myself or sing about my sadness, heartbreak, loss, desires. And I had a lot of that, you know. It was a record about, you know, not necessarily a breakup, but yearning for, for lost love and wanting to maybe fix some things with, you know, a particular person or a few people. And it was just a great outlet for that, to be that free. And I think that's what a lot of times, I think in that period of the early 2000s, there was a lot of great songwriters in a new rock way were coming out, like Pete Yorn and Ryan and, you know, folks like Jeff Tweedy. And it was just, there was a lot more of that happening, you know, so.
We have a lot of listeners that are also always texting me and tweeting at me about Pete Yorn and Ryan Adams. So my hope is that a lot of people are going to find Jesse Malin music now.
All right. Or that's, Degeneration.
Or Degeneration.
But Pete's great too. I toured with him a bunch and he sang at our show here in the Roxy in January and stuff. But I love what he does. And he's a sweet guy, you know, he's really down to earth, very just funny, regular dude, big heart.
Did you like the Hotel Cafe where you played last night?
Yeah, it's cool.
Were you annoyed though that people were talking? And
an acoustic show, you go on at 10 o'clock, and you know people are drinking in a club. It's not a theater. You know it's going to happen. I mean, it took two people. I mean, I kind of know how to focus in and try to get them to shut up, but and it becomes kind of part of it. But it didn't wreck me. The sound was loud enough.
You didn't seem angry, or you didn't
it wasn't
seem,
at that point. And they were nice. They said, "We're talking about you."
But, I know, and you're like, "Yeah, but talk about me afterwards."
Yeah, it takes one or two people to be very distracting. You know, when you're playing that quiet and you're focused, or you're telling a story.
That's also a drunk person's answer. We're just talking about you.
Yeah, it happens.
So it's
you got to be ready for it. You know, if I was playing like a really pristine theater, maybe a little more respect, but it, you know, the bar's right there and people are shooting shots back.
I saw Peter Wolf solo at that venue and he had a band with him and he was yelling at people all night because they wouldn't shut up when he was talking and they wouldn't.
Yeah. Some people get a little nastier than my Patti Smith routine, but yeah, it was okay though. It's not like a night where it is like somebody where it kept going and you know, I've had those nights where
the sound was, it sounds great in that room. The sound
was
great.
Yeah. We brought our guy, Mark, who travels with me, Mark Lewis, like a front house guy. It's he's part of the band. So,
and who was on stage with you last
night? Derek Cruz, who is on my records and is a writer as well. We've collaborated on a lot of great songs and produced stuff as well. He's a multi-instrumentalist, real talented guy I met who lives in New York, and joined by a guy from out here, Greg Foreman, known as The Pharmacist. He plays with Cat Power, and we met through James Williamson of The Stooges. We were doing something out here at the
very,
Bootleg Theater.
Very tall gentleman.
Tall guy with a cool rock and roll haircut and great
totally,
talented keyboard player. Yeah, Greg's been around and still does great stuff.
Yeah, when we walked in, he was there, and my friend said, "Is that Jesse?" And I go, "No." I go, "That's a rock guy, but that's not who we're here to see." But we did get to see him. So then a year later, another album, The Heat.
Yeah, The Heat was the second record for a label that Danny Goldberg had called Artemis. And after touring the first record, I wanted to write about some other people, not just about myself. And it was George Bush time, and I was going overseas a lot, and people wanted to know a lot about America and what we thought about what was happening. And you know, it was post September 11th, which, you know, being a New Yorker, it was, like I said last night, you know, the world's been a screwed up place for many years, but for ages and thousands of years and whatever. But some of this stuff now feels closer to home and more personal, maybe to some of my people, you know, when it's happening at music shows and venues that I've played, like the Bataclan, or when it happened in New York, and just watching how it affected us. I brought a lot of people together and just the sadness and the recovery of it. And what people had to do, scrambling jobs. And, you know, the first year was pretty tricky and it was just awful. So that kind of crept into the record, too, I think, with The Heat. And, yeah, that came out. We toured that a whole bunch. And I think Pete Yorn sings on a song called Swingin' Man on that record, now that I think about it. And Ryan, again, played some fantastic guitar. He was busy. He was going to almost produce it, and he kind of did in a way. And then I kind of took over. It says it's produced by me, but... it's the only thing that I'm aware of that I've produced in this world.
Never been married.
Never been married, you know.
No
I've
kids.
Had a lot of relationships, and I believe in love and the connection of two people and what that is and stuff. But no children that I'm aware of, no. And no marriage yet. But I'm still growing up, you know, figuring it out.
Well, here's from The Heat. This is Mona Lisa. It has like a George Harrison guitar
string. Yeah.
selling marijuana uptown to the prima donnas. Medicate the counterculture, 9/11, baby, boom. Polly's waiting to retire, smoking like a forest fire, putting on the panties and the lipstick in his mother's room. Nothing to do.
How long does it take to record The Heat?
Well, it took a long time. That took maybe about 5-6 months of in and out of touring. Mm-hmm. I was trying to figure out how to finish it. Ryan had started working on it, and just hearing his guitar playing on there and everything, I realized, wow, again, he added so much. We were doing it between touring, so mm-hmm. we were touring a lot.
It still comes out the following year. Yeah,
we got it pretty fast. I know. At that point, the drummer on there, I was just listening to him, Paul Garisto. He plays with the Psychedelic Furs and played with Iggy Pop, and he's on a Ryan record, Love Is Hell, and a bunch of stuff. But what's the guy from Depeche Mode, David Kahan, I think?
Yeah.
And just hearing him, the way he hits the drums, I don't listen to these records very often. But
Whenever I have an artist or musician in here, they no one ever listens to their own music. They play it nightly, but you're not listening to it with headphones.
Well, the record was, how we play it so different now. It's a lot faster, that song, and it's got a laid back sleaze to it. But Paul Garisto, they always say you're only as good as your drummer, and man, I have a great drummer. Randy Schrager plays with me now on my records, and he's fabulous too on the new stuff. But hearing back in those days, 2004, yeah, Paul's. It's great. And Johnny Paisano, the bass player, was on the first.
Well, that can't be a records. Real name. You made
it
that
is.
Name
yeah.
Up.
No, he's from Brooklyn. Yeah. plays with a guy named Willie Nile now, a guy that you might want to.
I know who
check.
Willie. Yeah, I've heard
he'd be good
Nile.
On your program. Got stories.
So last night you referred to an album that was your California album.
Yeah, Glitter in the Gutter.
Glitter in the Gutter from 2007.
Yeah, where I lived out here for 6 months, and I was on Adeline Records, which is a label that Billy Joe, Green Day guys mm-hmm. had started up. I think they still have it in some form or another. And they were, doing their thing, and they were very cool and generous to me, and I ended up out here working with them and their manager on that label. And it's more of a rock record, more of a pop record. I think it was a record that was, reaching for some other kind of audience, and sometimes those records work out, sometimes they don't. I think it worked out in the sense that, it's a good record.
But do you change your writing style because you're...
I was trying to make maybe the choruses a little bigger, but, the producer I worked with was really pushing, we got to see further with this and hit this harder, and, we spent more time and money on it, mm-hmm. and sometimes that can not work out, but I think it did. I think they did a good job, and it was just a bit of a change. I mean, every record as an artist, you should evolve to some level. It's not like I don't like when bands completely changed and they went metal, and but it has to be some kind of evolution that makes sense. I think we see that with the Beatles and of course the Clash and anybody, but so we're going another direction. It was fun being out here, as much as it's different and as much as I bag on it, but it was still a good experience to record actually behind this big clown you see in movies, but on the Circus Liquors, if you seen some of these movies, this clown on top of a liquor store. Yep. We recorded right behind it in an alley.
Well, this is a great, I love this record a lot. Yeah. I really do. Maybe it's because I live out here. But this is Don't Let Them Take You Down.
A new generation and the whole world shaking. We were born in flames, made in names, suburban homes. Make your bones, bite your lip, take the fill.
Quite a few songs under 3 minutes on this record too.
Yeah, that always works good.
Yeah, that makes
that's
it,
not a bad thing.
No, that's not a bad thing. Now, a song that I talked about, when it came out, was is Broken Radio, because you got some action with this, let's say, because of Springsteen is on it with you.
Yeah,
And how did that happen? Tell me the story of...
He had heard my first record at Fine Art of Self-Destruction and called me on the phone, believe it or not, and said all these nice things. I thought I was dreaming or tripping or something.
Now, how does Bruce Springsteen get your phone number?
He gets his management, get in touch with my management, and my manager said, Bruce is going to call you, and he didn't call, so I thought she was full of shit, but it was a couple more days, and then the day after Thanksgiving, I remember, because, you know, the city gets so quiet on holidays, and the Friday after Thanksgiving, I just woke up, and... there was a message. So I called him back because I don't wake up early.
Right.
And the first thing he said, I said, yeah, I just woke up. He goes, I missed those rock and roll hours. And we talked for, you know, a good long time and just about the record. And he, you know, had a lot of great things to say. And I said, it's all Ryan that did all of it. No, he wanted to know a lot about the production. Mm-hmm. No, he really liked the production. And the, you know, of course, he said some nice things about the songs. And
yeah, I like that song called Wendy. That's a good one.
Well, we end up doing some of those songs. He asked me to do some shows, some holiday shows in his town in Jersey. A New York guy, it's pretty close. So we went down there. And
well, how can you, you can't say no to Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, and you know, I thought we were going to do Christmas songs. So I'm like, yeah, I know the Run, Run, Rudolph and, you know, that Ramones Christmas song. And he said, no, we're going to do your song. It's going to be Max Weinberg and Nils Lott, you know, most of his band and some other folks that were great. And we rehearsed and I'm with him. It was very unreal. And we did two or three nights in the Paramount, a convention hall, not the Paramount, the convention hall, beautiful old place in Asbury. And he was very complimentary. And on the bill was like Sam Moore from Sam and Dave and John Bon Jovi, you know, it's a local charity for the holidays. And Steve Van Zandt sang a really cool Ramones tune. And I'm trying to remember who else was up there, but it was a real good Carlin Jeffries, I think. And
Southside Johnny, maybe?
I think he came one of the nights, And I met David Chase from The Sopranos and Danny DeVito. And I was having like a great time. And I went out to some restaurant with Bruce and just talked music. And so we stayed in touch. You know, we would invite me out to some rehearsals for, you know, other records, Seeker sessions. And then I was going to move to L.A. and I went to see him up in Boston. And I said, I'm going out to L.A. to make what would be Glitter in the Gutter. And he said, well, you know, if you need me on anything, I'm down. I'd, you know, love to be part of it. Keep me in mind. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. So I said it to the producer, Rob Caggiano, the guy who did the record.
Now, when he says that to you, do you believe him or do you think that's just something nice that someone
says? Well, with him, this guy was so sincere and so giving and we'd stay in touch and I'd come to different shows and hung out in the dressing room. You could see that he's just, you know, all the stories, but he's real deal, honest, you know, from the heart, a lot of integrity, no bullshit. So, yeah, I said to the producer, you know, Bruce wants to do something. I figured he's just going to play a guitar solo, count off one of the songs or, you know, play some guitar or yell.
One, two, three,
yeah. Oh. Yell hey or something, and you know, didn't want to make him do too much. And the producer said, no, you got that song. I said, what song? He said, you know, the one you wrote about your mom when she passed away, and it's called Broken Radio, or I don't know what it was called at the time, On the Radio. And my mom was a, you know, frustrated singer, singing the car to the radio, and it was about her. So he said, send that to him, and maybe you guys sing it together. And it took me a second to get around that idea because it was a personal song, and then I said, all right. I wrote the letter because I was big on letters and lyrics, handwritten, and sent it out to New Jersey.
Snail mail with a stamp.
Yeah, yeah. And put my phone number. I had a new cell phone at the time. And I'm driving on Sunset and Vine out of the place called Sunset and Vine. I was staying right over by Amoeba. And the phone rang. And, you know, Ms. Bruce, he said he liked the song. And that, you know, come on out if we wanted to come out to Jersey when we got back to the East Coast. So we left here and flew out there and went to his studio. And he came in and, you know, drove up on a Harley down this gravel road. It was pretty neat in the middle of nowhere. He couldn't find his place. It was like Apocalypse Now, like, you know, Colonel Kurtz or something. But
I was having trouble finding this place. My Waze wouldn't work.
Yeah, he didn't need that. He knew he had his bike. And we did that. And we did the video. Danny Clinch, great photographer and filmmaker.
Yeah, you got him in the video too.
And then we went and got together again and did the video, which was really neat because, you know, you sit around with two guitars waiting for them to get the lighting right and the shot right, and two guys just screwing around on guitars, and that was fun, like in between doing this video. So it was unbelievable to have a song about my mom, a song that was that personal and heavy to me, and then have this icon, someone who was a big influence on me when I was getting out of punk, and I wanted to write songs that had meaning and it had some reality and feeling to them. Nebraska would be a big, big thing, and the starkness of it. And then Born USA came out, and because I was already hooked on his lyrics, I thought it was great. I thought it was had a lot to say.
Yeah.
And my friends thought it was like, you know, well, what do you mean? This is like Rambo and patriotic. I'm like, get the lyric sheet.
Yes.
This is not what you think.
Yeah.
This is It's on our team, and he's on the right side. You know,
misinterpreting it like the way Ronald Reagan misinterpreted
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So there was people, I guess, that worked that way, but he made it as clear as he could, and it stands up still, that record. But yeah, it was a great thing, and we did that song, so it was fun.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Broken Radio.
I was thinking about another time, still in my mind. To know a little girl high on this world. Your baby loves you more than you know. Raised on revelry and rock and roll. Moving to the motor city so she lets go. On the radio. Well, we never had a lot of cash, but we love those kids. Some say that she missed the boat, but she just burned the bridge. The angels love you more.
Now, when a song like this is, you had written it for your mom. Is it hard to sing this live? A song like this that's
sometimes
personal?
Yeah, and you know, I've done it with Bruce a couple times live at some charity stuff for Parkinson's disease, Light of Day. Twice, I think we've done it, and it gets there. We don't play this one that often. It's kind of keep it for special moments.
Yeah.
Even if he's not there, I've done it. You know, I'll sing both parts. But yeah, this one definitely hits. Pulls on the heartstrings and knocks you in the gut a little for me. Listening to those strings, yeah, I forgot. Those strings are on there. We'd finished the record. We'd been out of budget, and which was a nice-sized budget. And we for those days, you know, 2000s, when the music business was dying. And they're very good to me to finish it. And I wanted to hear these strings on it, or the producer did, and we were out of money. So a good pal I reached out to, a guy named Howie Lipson, if he's listening, he gave us the money for those strings.
Oh, that's nice.
And that was a loan, and but he never asked for them back. And
now he's going to hear it.
Yeah, and call me up. But you know, you get these patron saints, you know, or something like that. But that was neat to do, and it was fun to work with the producer Rob Caggiano, because you know he pushed everybody equally, whether it was Bruce or me. He just acted like, you know, he just did what he did and just was like, hey, sing it like this. And, you know, you go to Bruce's house and Bruce knows what he's doing. He's got his own engineer there and everything. And the guy was producing just, you know, it was the same as he was talking to me or Bruce. He just was very, very real to who he was, and he did great.
And that's cool. It wasn't like just he's talking down to you and not to Bruce.
Yeah. No, I wasn't talking down to Bruce. It was very respectful.
You're just treating both as equals.
Yeah.
And then another song, and this is, since I didn't know Broken Radio was about your mom, but another song on this album is has my mom's name. It's Lucinda.
Oh, yeah.
So let's play some of Lucinda. And after Glitter in the Gutter, you decide to do a covers record.
Yeah.
And I want to ask about covers records, because like when you pick some of my favorite songs of all time and some, you know, iconic songs, how do you make that your own, or what's in your, like, for me, I would say like, well, I'm not going to cover that song. I can't do
Yeah, I just try to find a way. You don't want to be a karaoke cover band. Right. You know, I guess we had been asked to do these covers for tribute record things on Mojo and Uncut magazines on the cover.
Those things you get for free. Those are cool.
So I had done Hungry Heart already for one of those or for Light of Day, and I wanted to change it. It wasn't my favorite of Bruce's repertoire, so I made it slower and tried to do a more of like a Suicide Flaming Lips drum machine thing. And I felt like, all right, I've got my own take on this. And I had done Bastards of Young by the Replacements and made it a piano ballad. Like, I like the idea of taking, you know, a fast song and making it a ballad, or, you know, just changing stuff up. So I don't think I'm the greatest singer in the world, so I'm going to end up sounding just like different than Elton John for sure, doing his songs, you know, probably not as good. But it just was something, a labor of love, like making a mixtape for somebody, you know, where I wanted to have, like I said last night on stage, like something that was, you know, all the things I cared about, schizophrenic record collection from the Kills to Jim Croce, from Elton John to the Bad Brains to the Hold Steady to, you know, Neil Young. And so I just did it for fun, and it was just one of those records just to do. And part of when we did the first album tour, we only had that one record. And so we needed other songs and play covers.
Same, play covers.
Yeah, a couple to show where you're coming from or have a chance to screw up a song and turn it into something.
And this album, there's two different versions.
There's an English one and there's an American one, yeah.
The different songs.
There were so many songs that we covered that we said, let's make it like when we were kids buying those imports. And
yeah.
The Clash in the UK was different than the Clash record in America.
And, you know, the Rolling Stones Beatles. Aftermath is different from the
Yeah,
US
so
aftermath.
We were kind of getting on that. It was just, it got a little carried away, though.
Well, you brought up Elton John, and this is one of my favorite songs from Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. So
great record,
Harmony.
Yellow Brick Road.
Yeah.
Baby, hello. Haven't seen your face for a while. Have you quit doing time for me? Or are you still the same spoiled child? Hello, I said hello. Is this the only place you thought to go? Am I the only man you ever had? Or am I just the last surviving friend?
Go right into Paul Simon.
Remember, Pajama rolled out of bed and she ran to the police station. When the papa found out, he began to shout, started the investigation. It was against the law, it was against the law. What the mama saw, it was against the law. Mama looked down and spit on the ground every time my name gets mentioned.
I like your versions of both of those songs.
Oh, cool.
Those are both cool. And then, so that's 2010, and then you do another album in 2010, and this is, it's not just you, it's Jesse Malin and the St. Mark's Social.
Yeah, it was a more of a band thing, more of a rocking thing. We did with a producer named Ted Hutt. He had just done Flogging Molly and the Gaslight Anthem, and I signed to a new label, Side One Dummy. Cool rock and roll punk rock label out west here, and we did that record, a very New York sleazier rock kind of sound.
This is a fantastic album. I love this album.
Oh, really? Thanks.
And here's my thing. I don't know why that you are not a household name.
Well, tell somebody.
I know. Who do I tell?
Fix that.
What do I do? But because you've recorded so much music, so much great music, and it's the music industry is so. Well, you're in it, so you know, but it's so tough.
You got to enjoy doing this. If you don't, you know, there's so many days that are tough. You drive and there's no money, or, you know, some days are amazing. Some days you're getting paid great and playing wonderful audiences, but you got to love what you do. And, you know, for me, I'm kind of this artist. I've been around a while now, and, you know, I have a nice loyal fan base, but
right.
Yeah, you know, I'm still hungry for other things. We go out and open for different people, and you got to, not get like, well, I wish I was like that. You got to try to find appreciation in where you're at and still keep your hunger, I guess. I mean, that's just for me anyway. But it gets challenging. But I love doing it. And when you step back and, you know, or you get to a certain show and you connect with an audience and they're giving you something to something you created and they have their own feel for it and spit it back at you. And it's a good thing that kind of lifts spirits, you know, something in music that's very medicinal. So,
and what about movies and TV? Have they found you? Have they licensed Jesse Malin music?
I've had some songs in some films. Maybe I'd like, you know, right now I'm connecting with some people that want to do a lot more. Mm-hmm. A lot of times to keep the band together, because I was a solo artist, I had to sell my publishing to get a nice fat check to be able to pay for the tour bus and the band and salaries and all. And, you know, so I could live. So sometimes some of the records got tied up in publishing sale, you know, having other places that didn't do anything with them. But I'm in the process of getting a lot of that back, and there's some re-recording of some of our favorite songs that we had, me and the guys, and then, you know, with new stuff. But I feel, you know, still excited, and I still wake up like, you know, what is that, the Mickey Mouse Club, anything could happen day, you know, like we got to make stuff, and I try to stay as positive as I can in a crazy, you know, kind of world where the music business people say, oh, it's done, and rock and roll is not very dangerous anymore. They got the School of Rock summer camp down on Beverly Boulevard. You can enroll Rock 101, and you know, it's very commonplace, but it's still something I love to do. It feels right, and it's from the heart, and sometimes it stinks to have to deal with all the things around it, you know, to make it happen. But once you get there and, you know, the lights are on and the music hits, you know, it takes away a lot of the pain.
Well, let's hear some stuff off of this album that I like called Love It to Life. This is a song called All the Way from Moscow.
The Russian rain was falling on the Golden Arch. I felt your interest fading through the wild. And the gypsy kept on playing his nylon string guitar. From Moscow to New York. And watch the dirty river roll by. And I dedicate the ceiling to the ones in my life. And watch the dirty river roll by. And we medicate the culture so you're high and dry. And you don't get your money back.
And then I'm going to go into Burn the Bridge.
Dealing with a feeling as a child who's unheard. Some pledge allegiance while the others mouth the words. Come on. It's out there if you want it.
I assume you're always writing.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you take a little break just to build up a lot of stuff. But right now, you know, once you get in a period, I mean, I'm working on a new record, but I always have like a pen with me, or I'm writing on my phone. People think you're texting, you're writing into the notes section of then watching films.
You can sing
a song. I record the voice notes are chock full of stuff from sound checks, from sitting on a bus or any. But yeah, it is something that, you know, I sit by, you know, if I'm watching a show or a movie or at home, I got the pen and the paper. Ideas just come, or you hear the way people speak, somebody says something and a whole idea for a song, or I just collect things that I hear or like. And then if I'm in a, you know, place where I need an extra line, or maybe it'll inspire a whole song, I have this notebook of things that I've just written down that either I, you know, picked up hearing or from a movie or conversation, or just happened to think of walking down the street. You know, I say, like, I like walking in cities, the moving forward, you know, that whole thing keeps the brain going. You just get out of your house and just walk around, and songs just start to happen.
And then last night during your show, you let us in a little behind the scenes of how Jimmy Buffett writes songs.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I was joking around with that one.
You were?
Yeah, we were in Key West at a BMI showcase for songwriters, and I was just venting a little bit, but yeah, it was all right.
But you said Jimmy Buffett writes songs on a yacht getting a rim job.
Oh, yeah. That's, I guess I said that.
That is what you said.
All right. That's a new one.
That is well,
I'm sorry you remembered that. And
I remember because I was cracking up. I was crying because that was making me laugh. So since 2015, you've made three albums and an EP. You got Outsiders, New York Before the War, and then an album with a reunion album with D Generation.
Yeah,
and then the EP. That's a ton of music.
Well, there's a big break though. To be honest, not to slap myself around here on the back. The 2010, which you played, Love of Your Life. We went till 2015. It was a 5-year gap, and there's a lot of songs built up.
What do you do in that 5 years?
We toured a lot. St. Mark's Social was a fun band to be on the road with, and we just were on the road constantly. And then I think I had a little bit of writer's block. I didn't really know what direction I wasn't going to go in when I grew up or whatever, and I didn't know. So and then once it breaks, then it pours in, and we had a lot of songs. We did one record with Don DeLago, another artist at his Velvet Elk Studios in the Poconos and down in Virginia, some of it, and then went into the city and did at the Magic Shop, the studio where it just closed. If you watch the Dave Grohl Sonic Highways, the New York one is mostly about about Magic Shop Studios.
Yes.
And where David Bowie did the last two records before he died, and they were done like very secret near his house. The studio was in Soho. And so we were there with a lot of people that worked on the Bowie records and Black Star and the Next Day. And so we did New York Before the War, a lot of it there, and Outsiders, most of that with Don DeLago in more rural areas. And then the D-Generation record was done in the basement of rehearsal rooms that we have down in downtown Lower East Side of Manhattan with our front house sound guy, Mark Lewis. So, that was done really raw and kind of fast. But yeah, a lot of stuff came out in a short period, a lot of vinyl.
And you seem like it doesn't matter if you're in a big expensive studio or if you're in a basement, you just like to write and record and create music.
Well, you want it to sound good, but sometimes it just works. Like suddenly, wow, this sounds cool like this. Let's keep it like this. We don't need to spend all that money and go there, or, maybe we will, but, it's an art form, and you hear yourself in different places. It adds to what you're creating, the sound, the equipment, and the difference in the room. And, it's just like playing in different venues. You get a different feeling, or a different city, different crowds.
Right.
So,
well, I want to play a song from Outsiders. I want to try to play songs from all these albums so that people will go and find these albums on iTunes. These are all on iTunes and Amazon.
Spotify, all those things that pay big.
You can stream a lot of this. You can stream a couple of your albums on Amazon if you're a Prime member, and you can hear the whole album.
Okay.
So that's some mailbox money.
All right, I hope so. I'm waiting.
This is from 2015 from an album called Outsiders. This is All Bets Are Off.
Bobby was a postman working for the system. Never did a bad thing. His family's gonna miss him. Last house on the mail route. Always kept the lights down.
And then from New York Before the War, I'll let you pick one of these. I have Addicted, Oshina, or She Don't Love Me Now.
She Don't Love Me Now.
You played that one last night, didn't you?
No, we didn't, but we should have. No.
I haven't looked at my notes the whole time, which is good. Who do you seek out new artists now and listen to? Do you check Spotify out, or what do you do?
Sometimes on playlists and weird things, other artists will make lists of stuff. Go to clubs and bump into things. New York is small and full of all kinds of live stuff, and sometimes somebody will just tell you, check this out, or I'll read magazines, like the English magazines are pretty great, or magazines in America like The Big Takeover and different things like that. Yeah, there's a group out here called LA Witch that opened up, or actually we opened for them. We did like a double bill in New York recently. Mm-hmm. They're a younger band from Silver Lake that I like a lot. A lot of other artists, a band called Hollis Brown that's out of the New York area from Queens. It's a really great kind of Americana rock and roll band. It's kind of hard sometimes to remember all the stuff that I listen to that's new. And then, you know, there's other people that are making great new records. The new Craig Finn record is great. Matthew Ryan, who's going to be touring with me in Europe, has a great record out.
Cool.
That Brian Fallon produced from Gaslight. And, I mean, there's lots of cool stuff for sure. You just got to look harder. You know, it's easy to play the old records that we all are familiar with, but they don't always give you that fresh inspiration that you need from something you haven't heard. It's hitting you for the first time.
Do you have a go-to, like, album that you still means so much to you that you still listen to?
I have a few, but London Calling by The Clash, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road by Elton John, Nebraska, Bruce Springsteen would be one, Russ Never Sleeps, Neil Young, Sam Cooke records, the Bad Brains Roar cassette, which I mentioned earlier.
And is that is the Bad Brains Roar cassette? Can you is that on?
Yeah, you can get that everywhere at the Roar Sessions now. Okay. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah, the song that All Bets Are Off reminded me of something that could be on Nebraska.
Oh, cool.
Kind of like that
yeah,
vibe.
That's good. Yeah, it's a creepy story, I guess.
Yeah, what's going? I was yeah. When I was listening to that today, I was like, "What's going on?" Does he? What happens?
These people working in a meth lab and you know make well in somewhere out you know out west in one of those weird towns that mm-hmm. no one's around and this a murder happens. So yeah.
And where does that come from? What headspace are you in when you come up with this story?
Like? I don't know. Sometimes people tell you weird things that happen where they're growing up or you know things that could go or maybe I don't know watch the wrong movie or something.
It just sticks in
but
there.
But sometimes yeah or you know sometimes I'll read an article or something in a paper or you know and you know some weird card game where these people got into a lot of trouble and hot, you know weird things and stuff. That's a good idea for a song, you know.
Let me play a little bit of the D-Generation reunion album called Nothing Is Anywhere. Let's hear a little bit of a piece of the action. Sounds good. Were you happy with the results of the with that album?
Yeah, certainly, definitely. Danny Sage, the guitarist, produced it. I think I mentioned that earlier, but yeah, he wrote a lot of
it. Did you guys play many gigs on the East Coast? I don't know.
We did, and we came out here and did the Roxy, and we did San Diego and San Francisco and Portland and Seattle, and yeah, we came twice actually through.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, you have dates coming up. I want to shout out June 20, you'll be in the UK, June 29th, 30th, July 1st, 3rd, 4th.
Yeah, we don't get back till July 12th. I think the first gig on back in the East Coast is what, yeah. July 20th?
But we have listeners in the UK. Peter Spencer, Jesse will be in Manchester at Sound Control on July 4th.
Yeah, celebrating Independence Day.
Exactly, over in the UK. Your website is jessemallon.com. Easy. Twitter is at Jesse_Mallon. There was another Jesse Mallon.
I guess they grabbed it, yeah. Trying to make me buy it back. So Jerks. We said, we're going to underscore you.
I'm Pat_Francis, so.
All right.
I don't think that happened to me, though, but maybe with you, because you're.
Who knows?
Who knows?
It's a coincidence.
The show is that we are at Rock Solid Show. I want to thank Carla Parisi from Kid Logic Media for getting you in here for us and for inviting me to the show last night. I had a great time. And so this EP comes out June 30th. It's called Meet Me at the End of the World. You get it on vinyl, get it on compact disc. The vinyl comes with a digital download card, so don't be afraid of vinyl. It's got three songs, and I'd like to play out with one of these songs. I'll let you pick. Do we want to play Fox News Funk or Revelations / 13?
I think Revelations would be a good way to
all right. Well, thank
end
you
this party.
Thank you so much for coming here. I appreciate it. I know you took a lift.
Yeah, better than an Uber, it's better for you, better for the world. But that was great. It was great chatting with you.
Thank you so much. I will, of course, send you links if you want to put this on your website when it posts. But have a great tour of the UK. I'm so glad I got to see you in a nice, intimate setting last night with some storytelling and from some wisecracking and some some great music. And everyone go to iTunes or Amazon or wherever you go to get your music. And Jesse Malin, M-A-L-I-N, or D-Generation, and find this music and buy this music. So we're going to play you out right now with Revelations 13. Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you.
Meet me at Angelica's for the final scene. In black and white Evelica, you'll find the village green. Doctor, oh, doctor in mirror or mirage, Stockholm syndrome metaphor, blame it all on mom. I thought about a conversation as it played back in my head. I think I had a revelation, sick of calling on the dead. Purple hearts and question marks, she's still dressed to kill. Coffee shops and confidants, is she a friend of Bill? The promise of another year, a birthday in the fall, for a mighty moment dear, we almost had it all. I thought about a conversation as it played back in my head. I'm gonna make the transformation just like Bowie in Berlin. Everything's gonna be okay, gonna be alright, gonna be okay, yeah. Everything's gonna be okay, gonna be alright, gonna be okay. Won't you let me walk you home from school?